It's an easy ferry ride across the Gulf of Finland from Helsinki to Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. Its well-preserved medieval old town is one of the best in Europe.
These buildings that date from 15th, 16th century are still there for us to enjoy.
Coming up, Estonia expert Neil Taylor recommends what to see, do, taste, and understand about one of Europe's smaller countries, with one of its fastest-growing economies. He'll also explain why most Estonians would rather leave their years under Russian domination as a thing of the past.
They want the Soviet Union to be very much in the background.
Plus, Dave Carpenter helps us know what goes into the local beers of Europe, like the stouts they favor in the Baltics and in Ireland.
So that's barley that's not been malted, but it's been roasted like coffee, and that's what gives stout its dark color and kind of bittersweet taste.
Come along for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. The Estonians' love of choir music helped to bring about a mostly peaceful end to the Soviet era in their country with what we call the Singing Revolution. In just a minute on Travel with Rick Steves, we'll hear how Estonia is coming along 35 years later. And save room for a well-deserved pint as beer expert Dave Carpenter schools us on the variety of beers, ales, and lagers that have their home in Europe and remain a flavorful part of the local identity. As record crowds pack Europe's top destinations, savvy travelers are increasingly looking to break free from the mobs. And tucked away in the northeast corner of Europe, with just over 1 million people, Estonia offers room to breathe, perhaps in a steam-filled sauna or wandering the back streets of its charming capital, Tallinn. Long tossed around between Scandinavia and Russia, modern Estonia now stands apart from its neighbors. Its strong identity is rooted in resilience, from singing its way to independence from the USSR, to a thriving economy today as a digital pioneer. To take a deeper look at today's Estonia, we're joined by the author of The Brat Guide to Estonia and a book called Estonia, A Modern History. Neil Taylor has been enamored with this Baltic gem since it opened its doors to outsiders back in the early 1990s. Neil, thanks so much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you again.
So now, you're a Brit from Bristol, way on the west of England, and you are an Estoniaphile. How did this happen? How did a scholar from Britain become so enamored with Estonia?
It was during the breakdown of the Soviet Union that we were all, as it were, banned from Estonia, apart from 2 or 3 day trips to Tallinn, perhaps from Helsinki. And suddenly this country was open, together with its Baltic neighbours, with Latvia and Lithuania. And I was a tour operator at the time, and my considerations were purely commercial, that no one had been there for 60 years. It wasn't far from Britain. So let's give it a go.
And thank goodness tourism is booming in Estonia right now. Give us a little context before we dig in. First of all, the Baltics. People refer to the Baltics. Sometimes that's misunderstood here in the United States. What are the Baltics?
The Baltics, I think, in this context, are the three countries of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And let's say Scandinavia is Norway, Sweden, and Finland.
Another point of confusion for a lot of us is the difference between Scandinavia and Nordic Europe and then Slavic Europe. The Baltics are not Scandinavian ethnically, because that's limited to Norway, Sweden, and Denmark and Iceland, I think. Are they part of Nordic Europe and part of Slavic Europe?
This is very complicated, because you could say they're part of both, because 20% of the Estonian population speak Russian, so they're very Slavic. But the country, of course, is particularly opposed now to the new Russia. It was a reluctant member of the Soviet Union. You could also call it Nordic. Various presidents have preferred that, slightly in competition with their southern neighbours, with Latvia and Lithuania. They felt, well, they're a bit more advanced, so let's call ourselves Nordic, because Finland is really our model.
Now, we have the three Baltic countries that you mentioned, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. How are these three countries brothers or sisters, and how are they different? And how would you sum them up in just a nutshell?
The religion divides them. Now that religion is allowed, of course it wasn't in Soviet times, and Estonia is more Protestant, Latvia very mixed, Lithuania much more Catholic. To confuse things, the languages are totally unrelated with each other. I mean, Estonian, for instance, is related to Finnish, but has no links with Latvian, no links with Russian, no links with Swedish. So that distinguishes them. Cuisine can vary quite a bit, and government organisation is getting closer and closer now. If you'd asked me this question in 1993, I could have given a whole list of things which are totally different. But now, being EU members and NATO members, they are being brought together, and brought together willingly, not reluctantly, as was the case in Soviet times.
They are sort of a package deal, aren't they? The Baltic states, when it comes to NATO and the EU, they sort of come and go together, don't they?
Yes, they did. I mean, they joined them both in 2004 and have been regular, vociferous members, quite right, well, particularly in the context, of course, of the Ukraine war, because they're facing up to the Russian frontier. And so they realize what sort of country Russia is, particularly having lived in Soviet times, of course.
And I suppose we could actually trace it, a lot of their heritage, back to Hanseatic days, back before there were a lot of the countries we think of today. There was a trading league that stretched from London to St. Petersburg in Russia, and Tallinn was a big part of that.
Can I just interrupt that St. Petersburg didn't exist at that time? It was just a marsh, because Peter the Great founded it because he wanted an outlet to the Baltics. But as
Thank
a town,
you.
It just didn't exist. So
okay, so it stretched way up to the Baltics.
And Yes. And odd enough, Novgorod inland was part of it, but not St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg didn't exist.
Thank you for correcting me on that. It is an amazing power in medieval Europe, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
This Hanseatic League. And we go to Tallinn today.
And a very positive one through all those towns. I mean, they traded very effectively for 150, 200 years.
Gdansk, Riga, Tallinn, Bergen, Helsinki, I suppose, Copenhagen, big parts of that trading league.
Absolutely, yes.
All right. So now we've got sort of the broader context, Neil. And by the way, we're talking with Neil Taylor, and he's dedicated his research and his time to sharing his knowledge and his passion for Estonia and the capital city, Tallinn, with travelers, especially since Estonia gained its independence in 1991. Neil's the author of The Brat Guide, called Travel Guide to Estonia, and he's also written Estonia, A Modern History, and that book is recently updated for a third edition. You can find out more about his work in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So, Neil, we've sort of given the context here. Let's talk about Estonia itself. In the introduction, I mentioned it's just over a million people. Give us a thumbnail description of Estonia.
Yes, very wooded from the countryside point of view, very flat, so no mountains, dependent on the Baltics, has been, still is, for a lot of trade, toing and froing, of course, and making sure that that is an open sea. They used rivers for many years for their trade. We forget it was way outside the Roman Empire, so those of us living in Western Europe are used to long, straight roads, whether in Sicily or whether on the Scottish border. Well, none of that in Estonia. There weren't any roads until the late 19th century. So rivers were the means of transport in those days. Obviously not now. There are railways and wider roads.
Right. But we do have to remember there was a time when shipping was safer and more economic than overland travel.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, in Britain, the case, you know, boats went from Edinburgh to London. That was by far the easiest way to go than from...
But Estonia is, just to think that there's a million people that are native Estonian speakers, that's quite small on the planet.
It is, yes. I mean, there are a million native Estonian speakers, about 300,000 native Russian speakers, but integrating, because it's advantageous for the Russian speakers to do that, they have to learn, for a career, they have to learn Estonian properly. I mean, they can get very menial jobs just speaking Russian still, particularly older ones who can speak Russian to older Estonians who remember it. But the younger generation are learning English because that's the international language and need it for travel, of course.
Now, Estonia is dominated like almost no other country that I can... Well, I guess a lot of countries are dominated by their capital city, but Tallinn certainly dominates Estonia from a tourism point of view. And probably in a lot of ways. Talk a bit about the dominance of the big city, Tallinn.
Yes, well, this was an in-tourist legacy. In Soviet times, you could go to Tallinn briefly, about a 2-week tour, Leningrad, Tallinn, Riga, Vilnius, that's the other two capitals of Latvia and Lithuania, Moscow and out. So foreigners saw nothing else. So the feeling was, well, that's all there is. Then suddenly come 1991, you could go where you want. You could hire a car. You didn't need a visa. The rest of the country opened up. And that's taken time, of course, to pass on the message that Tallinn is not Estonia, that there's much more. They're the coastal resorts. And now with climate change, very advantageous going there in August. You won't get burnt. You can enjoy the sunshine without temperatures of 90, 95 degrees. The temperatures will be 75 to 80 degrees, probably.
All of Nordic Europe is enjoying a bump as people escape the heat, the unbearable heat of the Mediterranean in the summer, thanks to climate change. So you do point out that for 50 years, Tallinn was, or roughly 50 years, Tallinn was part of the USSR. And that means, from a tourism point of view, it's in tourist. And that was the, you know, if there's an authoritarian government in Russia, there's authoritarian tourism also. And tourism was dictated by in tourist. And these trips would just feature the capital cities and nothing more. I guess that might have been a practical thing because they're trying to control people and you just don't want people from the West or from Russia roaming around the entire country. You could pretty much focus them on the big cities.
That's right. Yes, it was easy because the attractive parts from the tourist point of view are small in each of these three capitals. So you kept them there and you had a good tourism product with Tallinn Old Town and the cathedrals and so on. You kept them there just for 3 days so that they didn't wander out into the suburbs or to other towns, things like that.
And that was my first look at Tallinn was back during communism before 1990. And I was struck then and I'm struck now how there's sort of a sister city relationship between Tallinn and Helsinki. And I think if you know where to stand and look at the right time, you can actually see the two cities from a distance on each other. You can certainly get their radio and TV. And that meant that Tallinn had more of a look at Western freedom during the dark days of communism than almost any other part of the Soviet Union. They were in Finland's media circle.
Yes, that's very crucial because the Finns could come to Tallinn, again, just for 2 or 3 days, and they stayed in an in-tourist hotel, and drink was cheap. And one has to say, for a lot of people, that was all they were particularly interested in, and they took out their duty-free back home. And that was very lucrative for the Soviet Union. It provided hard currency. For Estonians, it was psychologically good that they could actually see foreigners. Because, of course, as you say, elsewhere in the USSR, you didn't see foreigners and you didn't travel. And the boat coming was a psychological bond for them. They couldn't take it themselves in the other direction. But at least foreigners were showing an interest in their town. And dissident literature could be smuggled in so they could read much more than people elsewhere in the Soviet Union.
Neil Taylor's been called the world's leading expert to travel to Estonia, and he's with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Neil's been awarded the Estonian President's Medal for Services to Tourism and an MBE for contributing to the UK's bilateral relationship with Estonia. The British Guild of Travel Writers gave Neil its Lifetime Achievement Award in 2000. Neil has more advice on what to see and do in Tallinn and out in the countryside as we continue to explore Estonia in just a minute. Neil Taylor's our guide to Estonia right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He helped to pioneer tourism in Estonia as it became independent of the Soviet Union back in 1991. Neil and his wife divide their time between Estonia and England, and he writes the Brat Guides to Estonia and to its capital city, Tallinn. His book, Estonia, A Modern History, is out in its recently updated third edition. Neil, when we think about traveling in Tallinn, let's talk just for a minute about Tallinn. If you get to Helsinki in Finland, it's just a 2-hour boat ride or so across the Baltic Sea. People from Finland actually go to Estonia to get their hair done.
It's a day trip from Helsinki. Yes.
And it's such a beautiful thing to get off that ferry. I say if you got 3 days in Helsinki, the best thing to do on your third day is go to Tallinn.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
In fact, I would remind people that it's easy to fly in and out of Tallinn. I've done it many times. It's easy to take big ferry boats from Stockholm or Helsinki over to Tallinn. And when you're thinking about a Scandinavian capitals kind of tour, include Tallinn in that. It's more thrills than you'll get anywhere else from an adventure travel point of view. And Tallinn is like a fairy tale medieval town. It's beautifully preserved. It's got these wonderful fairy tale turrets and cobbled lanes, and it kind of embraces its medieval heritage, doesn't it? Can you explain to us the charm of Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, for us travelers?
Well, it is that. Very fortunately, it wasn't bombed extensively. It was bombed on one night, but not extensively in 1944. So you have got this intact medieval city. And of course, in Europe, so many of the cities that we discuss in these programs were bombed, but Tallinn was spared the worst of bombing, so it has been maintained. Of course, the buildings were stone, so that means they've survived. There were generations, whether the Germans were running the businesses, whether the Swedes were there extensively, whether it was part of the old Russian Empire, these buildings were carefully preserved. It wasn't the situation that each new regime wanted to tear down the buildings and replace them, and not even in the communist era. So these buildings that date from 15th, 16th century are still there for us to enjoy.
And in fact, my favorite memories of Tallinn are not blockbuster sites, but just the town as a whole, and to wander through the town with a local guide and just get a walking tour if you can somehow and enjoy the charm and the history wrapped into its beautifully preserved townscape. But there are a few things to do and to see in Tallinn. And if you were helping us design a great day of sightseeing in Tallinn, what would be the must-see sites or attractions for the first-time visitor?
Well, it is very tempting just to stroll, as you said, in the town. But if you want to study a little bit more about Estonia, you want the Kumu, which is the art museum. This is a couple of miles of walking, but interesting walking, or you can take a tram. Well, of course, for Europeans, perhaps less than American, trams are very special. We had them in our childhood, but they've disappeared from most European cities now. But they're very,
that's a good point.
They're very active in Tallinn. So you take the tram out to Kumu and the, shall I say, local imperial palace. It was built by Peter the Great for his wife, but neither of them ever actually used it. But as a building, it's still there, and it's a classical art gallery. But Kumu is a modern art building, and the art there is all sort of 20th century. And bearing in mind that most people have no idea what Estonian art is about, a lovely place to have a half an hour introduction.
I would remind people, Neil, at Kumu, it's the pride and joy of the arts society in Tallinn. It's such a beautiful museum. There is decades of social realism, which was the propaganda art that was the only art that was allowed during the Soviet period. And I'm fascinated by art as propaganda when you're ruled by a communist dictatorship. Wouldn't you say that's a good dimension of the collection there at Kumu?
Oh, it very much is, yes. So for political historians as well as for art historians, it's worth seeing, and also seeing how the Estonians evaded Soviet censorship to some extent.
Yeah.
Their flag is blue, black and white. And I mean, they certainly couldn't paint a flag, but they could somehow or other bring those colours into a lot of the artwork. So you see that, and the cat and mouse game that they were playing with the Soviet authorities.
And they got away with it. There's such a spirit of just a resilient spirit among the Estonians, and it shows itself in many ways, and that includes in its visual arts. Last time I was there was a big development in the old rundown industrial quarter. Isn't it called the Seaplane Harbour or
yes,
something like that?
Yes, that's right. Yes. So you have the whole naval history of Estonia, the submarines, and beside it is an old prison which has been reopened and will be developed in various ways. But that gives the grim picture of Soviet and even sort of pre-Soviet life for the prisoners who were actually there. But there's the Sea Museum. Then the whole area has been gentrified. So you've got the Sea Museum, as you say, the Sea Harbour Museum, and then you've got modern entertainment with it. So you could be academic, say, between 4 and 6 in the afternoon, and then have a very nice meal to follow at the seaside.
You got this edgy world with all sorts of street art and all sorts of avant-garde little galleries, and you've got wonderful artisans, a spirit of freedom and creativity. And you've got wonderful cutting-edge kind of eateries, and it's all in this sort of post-industrial context where you're in these once dilapidated industrial warehouses that have been turned into now thriving and creative cultural and cuisine spots.
And with an amazing number of people involved in it. And I couldn't give an exact figure for the number of serious painters there are in Estonia, but out of that million, it is quite extraordinary. And musicians too, classical, modern, and different styles of art.
It's a beautiful dimension of a city that could be overwhelmed by its medieval charm. Even back in communist times, the farmer's market over by the train station was always a delight. And you could see the babushkas with their cabbage on sale and their homemade cheese and so on. But now it is a combination of that heritage plus all sorts of trendy, hip, quite affluent market activities. And that's like the gateway to this whole former industrial wasteland that you can tie on to your Tallinn experience.
Very much so. And you've now got the restaurants from the former Central Asian republics, which are now independent countries, of course. So
there you go. And, you know, in the United States or Britain, when we eat ethnic, we might eat Thai or Chinese or something like that. But in the former Soviet Union, when you eat ethnic, you can eat Kazakh or you can eat Georgian or you can eat different parts of the vast Soviet empire.
And that is in the market now, which is particularly surprising.
I love it.
Yes.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Neil Taylor. He's been traveling to Estonia since it first opened to tourists with the fall of the Soviet Union. He's been the longtime author of The Brat Guidebook to Estonia. His own book, called Estonia, A Modern History, examines this tiny country's long struggle for independence and how it's become a thriving digital pioneer in Europe today. Neil, I'd like to talk about Estonian culture, just beyond the capital even, and just describe this Estonian spirit and what makes Estonians unique compared to their Baltic neighbors. Let's first talk about food. How does food reflect the mix of Nordic and Russian and Baltic influences?
Yes, the main influence is still German, interestingly. I mean, they brought their dishes when they came as businessmen, or they would like to say crusaders, in the sort of 14th, 15th century, and that has stayed. So the pork, the importance of potatoes, the size of the dishes, the very thick soups and sweets. So that has all come really from Germany rather than from Russia or Sweden or Finland.
And my favorite memory, I got to say, is this just cake-like, delicious, dark bread.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, Estonians, when they come to Britain, they can't get it and they're desperately frustrated. Yes.
It's the first thing I just delight in is that dark bread with, I don't know, it's just so simple, but it's just so organic and beautiful for Estonia.
Yes, yes. And I mean, you can eat quantities of it, either with something sweet, with jam, or of course with savouries.
Yeah. You know, when we think about this corner of Europe, we think of saunas. There's saunas in Sweden and saunas and steam baths and so on in Finland. What is Estonia's sauna tradition?
Well, very much so, yes. And for the tourists, of course, they've copied Finland and Sweden and realized that commercially it's very successful by charging less than the Finns. And of course, people come for a week in the winter when you're almost tied to the sauna because you don't want to go out in the pitch dark normally. But you can then have, well, all day or as much of the evening as you would like in the sauna environment. So have the swimming pools as well as the saunas and the spa.
Another dimension of Estonian culture is the music, and it's similar with Latvians in Riga and also the Finns, just a love of choral music, of singing. It's a very community-building activity, I think. What is it about music and singing that is so powerful and inspirational about Estonian culture?
Well, that brought the Estonian ethnic community together from the end of the 19th century, because the festivals songs were all in Estonian. So that was a way of sort of reminding people of the language of the country, even though it wasn't a country at that time. Continued when it became independent after the First World War, logically, because they'd been successful in the 19th century. So a reason why they shouldn't be even more successful in the independent country. And in the communist era, they were a way of battling surreptitiously the Soviet authorities, so smuggling in nationalistic songs. They were so fortunate, of course, Estonians, that the Soviets couldn't understand the language. Very, very few native Russian speakers can understand Estonian fluently. So by speaking it fast, by using dialects, old-fashioned
Well, that's
words,
one advantage. That's one great advantage of an obscure little language that almost nobody speaks, is you've got your own secret code.
It's called talking. It's like the Welsh going abroad. Well, they're not going to be understood except in
Patagonia. Well, when you go to Tallinn, high on the tourist checklist is the song festival grounds, right?
Yes, and that's where the festival takes.
A vast outdoor, like Hollywood Bowl, but four times as big, and you've got a stage. And historically, half of all the people in the country have gathered there for special days, haven't they?
They have, yes, at these festivals. Even now, I mean, in a sense, there isn't the political significance, but the standard of music attracts them. And, of course, Estonians living abroad, those who left after the Second World War, those who've emigrated more recently or toing and froing, as is possible now, it's a way of really being Estonian for several days.
Well, it's a way to speak up for your culture. I remember my friends in Estonia told me, you know, in the difficult times of the 20th century, we were totally outgunned. We had Germany on one side and Russia and the Soviet Union on the other side. And all we could do was sing to demonstrate that we are here and we're going to stay here. And that showed itself in what was called the Singing Revolution. And I remember the first time I ever watched a movie online was when I was in my hotel in Tallinn, so inspired by this Singing Revolution. And there's a very dramatic documentary movie called, I believe, The Singing Revolution.
Yes, it is. Yes. And that was
What was that Singing Revolution, Neil?
Well, that was very important in the Perestroika era. The Soviet Union said it was opening up. There were these words, glasnost and perestroika. Yes, those were the two words that people were using. And the Estonians very skillfully used it, pushed the barriers. The flags could appear very gradually. Political comment was more possible in newspapers. People could be just generally a little bit more daring, and where economically they could tell the Soviets, well, we should have more self-management, more management at the local level, because that'll make people more productive, covering up the fact that that was an excuse for nationalism, because it meant if you had local control, Estonians were running their own businesses and weren't asking Moscow if they could buy six paper clips.
Another thing I was impressed by, Neil, was the love of nature. And in Estonia, that's not the mountains of Norway or Switzerland. It's the forests, it seemed to me.
And the lakes. We mustn't forget the lakes.
The lakes. I remember a guide stopped me at a forest and he said the forest is actually a cemetery. And historically, we had our gods in the trees and we bury our loved ones in the forest to be sort of one with the forest. It was a unique approach to burial.
Yes. Well, they're very keen still on burial rather than cremation. And one has to say they don't have the pressures that we do, say, in Britain and the UK, or certainly in the bigger cities, where there just isn't room for a proper cemetery now. So the Estonians do want a burial on the whole, and they have family burial sites. They're not like the Italians in having very ostentatious ones, but the wood is what is important, the trees, because that is part of life. So in a way, it should be part of death as well.
Neil Taylor's updating us on Estonia as a tourism destination and as the most popular of the trio of Baltic states that used to be part of the Soviet Union. Neil first told us about Estonia on Travel with Rick Steves back in 2009. He's recently updated his book, Estonia, A Modern History, and the Brat Estonia Guidebook. Neil tells us more about the role of Russian immigrants in Estonia in an extra from today's interview. You can hear that on our website with the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Neil, I enjoyed reading your take on the uniquely dry and quirky and wry humor of the Estonian people. And you mentioned that there's a popular saying that an Estonian can stay silent in several languages.
Yes, that's right. Yes, they do feel that silence can contribute. I mean, I've not tried it. It'd be rather rude, wouldn't it, to go to a party and stare at somebody for 2 or 3 minutes and not say anything. But communication works nonetheless.
They can be deadpan and not. And if you didn't really have a sense of what's going on, you wouldn't even realize you're in the middle of a joke.
That's right, yes.
Neil, we got to wrap things up. There's so much going on in Eastern Europe right now and in Baltic Europe right now. Can you just give us a sort of a final wrapping up of your take on how Estonia is doing with the tug-of-war between East and West as a member of NATO and as a member of EU, but also feeling the possible threat of Russia if Russia succeeds in Ukraine. A lot of people think they'll put their sights on the Baltics and Poland. Where are we at now, and what is your hope and your concerns about the future?
Well, for my reassurance, I go straight to the Estonian-Russian border. The third city in Estonia is Narva, and it's on the border. There's the river Narva, which is the border between Russia and Estonia, and one still sees the fishermen on either side gossiping, as they all speak Russian. Very difficult to cross the border. That stopped largely for now, but I mean, not totally impossible. But the peace there is quite extraordinary, and it doesn't have a military atmosphere on either side. You see the two fortresses dating from Swedish Empire times and Russian Empire times, but I'm then confident that this is the long-term relationship that Russia and Estonia is going to have. Also, Estonia as a NATO member, I think this is crucial, and was gratified that both the Swedes and the Finns gave up their so-called neutrality and joined NATO. And that means now that the whole Baltic area, from Denmark right through to Finland, is practically entirely under one defence umbrella. Now, of course, the Russians have St. Petersburg and can drive into the Baltics, but at least the other countries are all united in a common approach to Russia. And the Russians must be realising that they are going to face up to NATO. They're not going to face up to a small country of a little over a million people.
Wow. It's a thrilling time. It's a scary time. It's a time where the more we travel, the more we understand each other and can empathize with each other. And I'm so committed to this idea that if you're privileged and blessed enough to go to a place like Estonia, the more understanding you bring with you, the more you'll get out of that visit. And that's the thing I love about your book, Reading Estonia, A Modern History. A traveler will come to Estonia and be able to really understand the excitement of this age and the resilience and the character of the Estonians that really are worth getting to know. Neil, thanks so much for joining us, and best wishes in your writing and your work.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be talking to you.
Lately, we've been hearing that the popularity of local craft beer production in North America may have peaked. Decreased demand is forcing some local brewers to close down. But the traditions of local styles of beer have long helped to define many communities across Europe, and they're still waiting to be enjoyed today. Beer writer, home brewer, and certified beer judge Dave Carpenter serves up beer in Europe. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. When I'm traveling, I like to eat what the locals eat and drink what the locals drink. My favorite way to order is to point to someone at the table nearby and say, I'll have what he or she's having. And in much of Europe, that would be beer. Like wine, beer has a long and tasty connection with local cuisines, traditions, and festivals, and it varies from country to country. We're joined today by a true beer aficionado, Dave Carpenter. He's a certified beer judge, a Cicerone, that's like being a sommelier, but for beer, and he's the author of Lager, the definitive guide to tasting and brewing the world's most popular beer styles. Dave also spent 2 years living in Berlin, enjoying the complete German beer experience. He's joining us today on Travel with Rick Steves to help us all better understand and appreciate the cultural dimensions of beer in our European travels. Dave, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
You know, it seems to me that Europe has a uniquely rich beer tradition, but maybe that's because I travel in Europe and not the rest of the world. How does beer compare with other regions from a global point of view? I mean, let's take a quick global review. Latin America, Asia, Africa, Europe.
Sure. So when you look at a beer menu, probably 75% of the time you can trace a style of beer to a European country.
Uh-huh.
There are certainly beer styles that are indigenous to the U.S., but they're sort of few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
There are some beer styles that have developed in Asia, but by and large, beer is a beverage that developed in Europe.
Okay. So that's not a Eurocentric point of view. That's just, in your mind, a fact.
Sure. Grain was cultivated in Northern Europe, and mm-hmm. that's where it flourished.
Do people drink a lot of beer in Africa or Asia or Latin America like they would in Europe? Are they as enthusiastic about their beer?
Certainly. I've had the opportunity to judge with beer judges from Asia and South America and Europe. And it's certainly the American craft beer revolution has spawned beer growth in other regions. Mm-hmm. And you do see that popularity around the world.
And from a quality point of view, would a beer aficionado, when they go to a Thai restaurant or a Japanese restaurant, seek a good local, a good Thai or Japanese beer, or would they just go with a European-style beer? Because that's on the menu also.
I like to order whatever's freshest and whatever's local. So yeah. If there's an import, if I'm in the U.S. in a Thai restaurant, if there's a Thai import and there's something brewed a few blocks down the street, I'll go with the latter.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because I live in a little town north of Seattle and we've got a great local brewery. And I kind of think for some reason that's a better beer to order here because it just feels local.
Absolutely.
There's a qualitative difference.
There's a qualitative difference. Beer doesn't typically travel very well.
Ah, that's a good point.
There are some that will, and part of the challenge is keeping it cold. Cold beer stays better longer, and shipping beer across the world cold isn't that economical. So your local brewer is more likely to serve a fresher example.
That's interesting. So you like this Czech beer, but if you had to refrigerate it all the way from there to the United States, they're going to have to either cut corners and it'll be less good or charge more than what'll the market
Absolutely.
Will bear. Dave Carpenter is the author of Lager, the definitive guide to tasting and brewing the world's most popular beer styles. Dave explained more about lagers on Travel with Rick Steves program number 808 in October 2025. You can hear that interview from our show archives. Dave's website is davecarpenterbooks.com. When you think about beer in Europe, I think of regional identity. I think of the same sort of pride you might have with a soccer team almost. In Spain, I've been down in Andalusia and I think, well, this is the beer the Spaniards drink. And then I go to northern Spain and nobody drinks that beer in the north,
right.
You know? It's a different, and they do it for pride reasons. If you go to Glasgow, I think you'll drink a different beer than when you're in Edinburgh.
Absolutely. It's definitely a regional thing.
Why is that?
I think these local traditions sprang up in a time before there was mass transit and mass communication. And so I sort of liken it to the way that you can hike from one valley to another in Switzerland and the dialect changes. And
That's a very good analogy.
I think it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases where there's wide open spaces, there's not as much diversity in the culture.
Right.
As if you live in Switzerland where they've got three different languages
right.
in that little tiny country because the mountains separated people.
The American brewery Anheuser-Busch was the first to pioneer refrigeration in rail cars for transport of beer. Prior to the early 1900s, it wasn't really possible to transport beer very well. So I think that explains why you see some of these loyalties.
Long traditions. So built up over a long time.
They've been there for a long time.
And if you drink the beer your grandpa drank and your dad drank and you want your kids to drink that beer.
Absolutely.
You've got loyalty.
I
feel that and I enjoy that when I look around and I kind of get a sense of that. In Ireland, you know, if I want a stout, you know, the tourist goes to Ireland, they have a Guinness.
Right.
But really, when you're in the South, you should order a Murphy's.
You should have a Murphy's. Murphy's or a Beamish even.
Okay. So that's just really a fun dimension of our travels. Now, when I'm going around Europe, it fascinates me that it's almost like there's different drinks. Your book is called Lager, and that's the that's the generic cold, sprightly beer that is sort of the default. If somebody says,
right.
I want a beer, that's what you get. But that changes a little from country to country. And I was just thinking, when I'm in Europe, I like to be a cultural chameleon. When I'm in Ireland, I drink stout. When I'm in Belgium, I drink that milkshakey monk kind of beer.
Uh-huh.
And when I'm in the Czech Republic, I drink a Pilsner, a great lager. Those are three very distinct drinks. I mean, if you didn't know your biology or whatever, your chemistry, you would think they're different drinks, but they're all beers.
They're all beers. If you take a clean German Pilsner and put it next to a spicy Saison from Belgium, you wouldn't even guess that they're in the same category.
Yeah, it's true. And then you go to a Belgian bar and they brag they got 300 different beers there. You've probably seen these bars.
Yes.
In Bruges and in Brussels, I suppose everywhere.
Everywhere,
sometimes
yeah.
I feel like that's like an ice cream store having 80 flavors is kind of a gimmick for the tourists. But there's certain people that go to that bar because they can get that one special beer.
And the Belgians are very serious about their beers. If you order a beer in Belgium, it will be served in the correct glass from that brewery.
That is fascinating because I've been in a bar in Belgium and I was hell-bent on having a, what is it, a blue Chimay.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, I'd love to serve you a blue Chimay, but we don't have the right glass.
Yeah.
And are you kidding me? I want a blue Chimay. But
right.
For a Belgian, they would say, no, you cannot drink it out of that glass. He would say, this glass works almost as well, you know, because they've
right.
got these a whole array of glasses hanging from the ceiling there at the bar. Why is that? And how important is that?
Well, there are sort of two components to it. One is a branding component. So if you're a brewery, you want to see your beer served in your glass. And so there's certainly a marketing component to it. But more broadly speaking, a lot of these glasses, even with different branding, will have shape characteristics that are appropriate for that particular style of beer. So a lot of the Belgian styles you might see in a chalice or in a tulip-shaped glass, which is different from, you know, the Stein, the Moskrug that you would see for, a Bavarian beer.
I love that. It makes a difference. I mean, I don't know if it's psychological or marketing or what, but the last thing I want to do is drink a great beer out of a can.
Out of a can. I'm with you on that.
I'm sorry. I just want to sit in a cool bar in some cool little town in Belgium. And I want the bartender to make sure I get the right glass.
Pour it in the glass.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're exploring the beer culture of Europe now with writer and home brewer Dave Carpenter. He's compiled a guide to the world's most popular type of beer, and that's his book, Lager. Dave's also a certified Cicerone. And that's sort of the beer equivalent of a sommelier. His website is davecarpenterbooks.com. So, Dave, a lot of times when we're traveling, we find religious orders, monasteries, monks, sort of as an integral part of the heritage of this or that beer.
Right.
I mean, I'm just kind of thinking right now, in so many countries, it goes back to breweries and monasteries. What's the deal?
So the breweries were often a way for a monastery to support itself. And you still see that today with the Trappist breweries that you find largely in Belgium, but also in the Netherlands and a few other areas, and they're able to brew beer, sell it to the public, and use those proceeds to support their work. And historically, breweries were intimately tied with the monasteries, and the church even had was able to tax beer according to what was put in it.
Now, does it also go back historically to the fact that in the Middle Ages, water was not safe? And beer
yes.
was actually a safe way to drink water, and beer actually had nutritional value.
Beer has nutritional value, and if you look at, for example, the Doppelbock, which is a dark lager, a strong dark lager, it's historically associated with Lent because the monks would fast, and they needed something with some calories to get them through that fast, and a nice strong dark lager was just the thing for that.
Okay, Dave Carpenter, my beer sommelier, the Cicerone. I'm going to just say a word, and you're going to define it in one or two sentences.
Okay.
Lager.
Lager is a clean beer that's been fermented with a specific yeast that works in the cold.
So it's generally a cold beer, a cooled beer. Pilsner.
Pilsner is, in the Czech Republic, actually a protected origin beer from the city of Pilsen. In wider vernacular, we refer to it as sort of any pale lager from the Czech Republic.
So if you order a Pilsner at a bar in the United States, you're going to get a Pilsner-style beer maybe
exactly.
produced here. And that is kind of a Czech lager.
Right. And then you do see the German variant Pilsner as well, German mm-hmm. Pils. The Czech one definitely has a protected origin.
Ale.
Is a beer that's fermented using a yeast that works better at room temperature. It's going to be less clean in the sense of having some fruity notes, maybe some spicy notes.
Less clean, would that be a little more complex?
Complex, exactly.
I was once at a bar in the south of England sipping my ale, and the man next to me said, I've never seen anybody try so hard to enjoy a beer he doesn't like.
We all have those.
Ale, real ale, what's that?
Real ale is one of my favorites. It's a beer that is served in the UK that is served from the vessel in which it is finished. So there's still live yeast in that beer, and the cask sits in the cellar. So the you'll see the hand pump at the bar. They're pumping that beer up from the cellar. It's going to be cellar temperature, and it's going to have a lower carbonation than your typical keg beer.
When I think real ale, I think Camra.
The Campaign for Real Ale, exactly.
C-A-M-R-A, the Campaign for Real Ale. What's that?
That is an organization that started in the UK to promote traditional British brewing and serving practices. It came at a time when there was a surge of what you would call fizzy yellow beer, or sort of generic lager.
Fizzy yellow beer,
yeah.
Masquerading as ale?
No, just if you go to the UK, for example, and you order a pint of lager, you're going to get a Heineken, Carlsberg,
fizzy yellow
beer. And so the Brits said, well, that's fine, but we have a tradition all our own.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. It's fun talking with Dave Carpenter. He writes a book called Lager, and I'm doing a little blitz through some things that I want to clear up. So I'm just going to give you another couple of words, and you're going to describe it in two sentences or
okay.
more or less. Wheat beer.
Wheat beer is a beer that's brewed with a large proportion of wheat instead of barley. It usually still has barley in it. And in Germany, that's most often a Hefeweizen, or as they say in Bavaria, a Weissbier.
So there's a real following for that. There's entire beer gardens that are dedicated to
There are whole breweries that are devoted to Hefeweizen.
And is it a fizzy sweet beer kind of?
It has notes of banana and clove are the two most common descriptors. And it tends to be very highly carbonated and very refreshing.
People are very loyal to that. And when I'm in the land of a great Bavarian lager, it just seems, it's my personal, a great thing about beer. You can have your personal opinion. But I just think you're in the land of, you know, lager. I just don't like the Hefeweizen.
You're not a fan of the Hefeweizen?
No, but people are.
Well, you can also, if you like dark beers, you can order a Dunkelweizen, which is the dark version.
Maybe I should try that. That's a good idea. Okay, stout.
Stout is a dark beer from the British Isles that's most closely associated with Ireland now, and it uses a large proportion of roasted barley. So that's barley that's not been malted, but it's been roasted like coffee, and that's what gives stout its dark color and kind of bittersweet
And some
taste.
people know what a Guinness is, mm-hmm. and it is basically just a stout that's brewed in Dublin.
It's a stout from Dublin.
Right. Novelty beer.
Novelty beer. That would be, for me, anything that sort of blurs the line between traditional beer and an experiment. So Kriek is a Belgian style that has cherries in it. It's based on a spontaneously fermented beer called Lambic. And it's got a funky sort of, some people describe like a horse blanket background to it. But the cherries really make it very nice.
If you're thinking of you're going to get a beer and you get a Kriek, you think, did they spill something in this?
Yes. I would encourage listeners to think of Kriek more like wine than beer. I think that shift in perspective, just thinking about it differently, can dramatically change the way you experience it.
Now, when I think of great beer in Europe, I think Belgium, Czech Republic, Germany, and the UK, if I'm looking for an ale. What does that mean for the rest of the countries? What's underrated? What should we appreciate outside of that? Is there any important beer in Greece, France, Portugal, Spain, other than the purpose of drinking with
right.
the locals, the local favorite?
France has two beer styles that are really worth looking for. One is called beer de garde, which means like a beer that's kept. It's kind of a little like a hybrid between a lager and an ale, and it comes in a bunch of different colors. You can get blonde, brown. Mm. You may have to seek it out, but if you're in France looking for beer de garde.
Now, when I go to my favorite wine shop in Paris, it's like a trip around Paris. Every meter or two, you have a different region of France where the wines are. And when you come to beer, they just have Belgian beer.
They just have Belgian beer.
It's just Belgian beer. It's a French wine shop. If you want a beer, you're going to have a Belgian beer.
Mm-hmm. I would suspect that France really isn't a powerhouse of brewing, but Belgium is. So I would suspect that's just proximity.
This is so much fun talking to you about the fine points of the culture of beer. It's a culture. I mean,
it is.
It's almost a pun because there's culture as part of the whole process, right?
Right.
By the way, we're talking with Dave Carpenter. Dave's book's Lager, the definitive guide to tasting and brewing the world's most popular beer styles. And Dave, if you had a friend who's going to Europe and they like beer and you want to make sure they get the most out of the experience, What's your basic advice for traveling around Europe and giving beer the attention you think it deserves?
I would do a little basic research. You can do that in your library or you can do that online. There are a lot of great apps now for finding what's local. There's one app that's widely used called Untappd, and you can see who has been checking in certain beers in certain areas. So if you arrive in a new city, you can pull it up and say, what are the bars nearby and what are people drinking?
And what are the bars nearby, I think, is just as important as what are they drinking, because part of the greatness of travel and beer is to enjoy that ambiance. And I can think of magical moments that the beer contributed to it, yes, of course, but it wouldn't be magical if I was sitting in a place that was built last year and filled with people who were not locals.
Right. It's one thing to sit in a generic bar. It's another thing to sit in a, you know, a 16th century coaching inn and chat with the locals who live there.
Yes, yes, indeed. Dave Carpenter, thanks so much for joining us. And when you're in Europe and you're going to clink glasses, what's your favorite Prost word?
I like Prost. I like Zum Wohl.
Zum Wohl.
Nastravi.
Yes, Nastravi.
Nastravi.
I say Nastravi all over the place, and I can remember it because it sounds like nice driving. So if I'm having a tough time with my words, I just say nice driving.
It's a good mnemonic.
Well, Zum Wohl to you, and
Zum Wohl.
Happy travels. Thanks, Dave, so much.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
In heaven, there is no beer. That's why we drink it here. And when we're gone from here, all my friends will be drinking all the beer.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Casmer Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show or search the archives. It's all at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Every year, over 30,000 people join our expert guides on a Rick Steves Europe bus tour. And about half of our tour members are return travelers. Details for each of our 40 itineraries, including departure dates and prices, are at ricksteves.com. And for a candid and fun-loving insight into each itinerary, don't miss our archive of hundreds of tour scrapbooks created by tour alums competing in our annual contest to win a free tour. And independent travelers can also learn from the day-to-day descriptions of our smartly designed tour itineraries. All of that is at ricksteves.com.